You know ID in the D in the town all day. ID in the D in the SEA. You know ID in the D in the town all day. ID in the D in the SEA.
Hello and welcome to episode number 96 of the Fabulous Pelton Cast. I'm your co-host Kevin Pelton.
And I'm Tristan Carcino.
And we are coming to you from Boulevard Park, Washington, back in the home of the Pelton Cast.
Oh! You know what I'm gonna say. You know what I'm gonna say.
Is it that it's good to be back?
It feels good to be back in Boulevard Park.
It always does.
And I tell you, oftentimes when we're recording in Boulevard Park, one of the main reasons that it feels good to be back is because I have previously been at Loretta's.
That is accurate.
And I've been drinking the home beer of Boulevard Park. And what is that?
Technically more of Georgetown, but okay.
That is the Rainier Tallboy.
Provided here for scale.
For perspective.
Yes, you tweeted out that photo, which I retweeted earlier. And now we are also drinking Rainier Tallboys.
For perspective.
I find they will help the perspective of the podcast. Mm. Much as they did at the live show.
That's refreshing.
It still doesn't taste quite as good as it was still the Jubilee can.
Slightly worse. We have a lot to get to this week.
We do.
Shockingly, every single week. It feels like it's been a long time since we've recorded, even.
It does, even though it's only been a week.
A lot of sports has happened, though.
A lot of different sports, which seems to be a theme lately. But I thought we should start, though, with a couple of sad toasts.
Oh, no.
First off, episode 96. It's the Cortez Kennedy edition of the Pelton Cast.
Huh, pour one out.
R.I.P. Tez, the legendary Hall of Famer. But also for Jordan Morris's 2018 season.
Oh, my God.
Which came to a premature end in El Salvador on Thursday night. More on that to come.
Look, is the season not long enough that he can't return?
They have ruled him out for the season, despite the incredible length.
Do they know how long the MLS playoffs are?
I mean, I think they're aware. I feel like Garth Lagerwey knows.
This is like a 16-month injury, then.
Something like that. Do we want to start by wrapping up something that has been going on and we've been discussing over the last several weeks here?
Are you talking about Burger Month?
I am talking about Lil Woody's Burger Month.
You're going to have to pull up the chefs of these last two burgers.
Okay.
Because we haven't talked about either of these last two, right?
We have not, because you had not previously eaten the previous week's one by the time we recorded.
I don't think that's true.
Okay.
But I have completed Burger Month at Lil Woody's.
Wait, is this a Doritos chip?
Yeah, I want that burger more than I want any of the Burger Month burgers.
Intriguing.
The burger of the week that came after the Burger Month burgers was a burger with Doritos chips on it and pepper jack cheese. And I'm like, that's what I'm looking for. So
week three was John Sundstrom.
And he had a burger which was the most basic of all the burgers. Again, no cheese, but it had a pork patty.
Yeah, the Oishi pork burger.
I enjoyed it for its simplicity, right? There was not a lot going on there. But at the same time, the flavor palette was almost completely the burger patty.
So you didn't get anything out of the yuzu aioli?
A little bit, but I mean, an aioli can only go so far.
Okay.
At the time, I thought maybe this might be my number one burger because of the simplicity of it.
But then was it surpassed? Or did you just reevaluate it relative to the first two?
I may have reevaluated it. I liked the simplicity. The fourth burger certainly did not surpass it, and that was
the Tuxedo Shirt Burger by Sean McCrane.
Does it say what restaurant they're from?
Let's see here. Bookbindery Restaurant in Seattle.
Oh, who hasn't enjoyed a great meal at Bookbindery? I'm sure it's a very good restaurant. This one had a lot going on in it.
All right. So, bacon relish, foie gras aioli, fried duck egg, Beecher's flagship cheddar cheese. That's pretty much it.
I'll tell you, it was rich. It was the most expensive of the burgers at $14. It was by far the richest of the burgers. You had to be rich to afford it. A lot of aioli on these burgers, I have to say.
Actually, by the way, he's now at Copine, Seattle.
Okay. There was just too much going on this and almost all of these Burger Month burgers. I have to say, if I can put all of Burger Month into perspective, I think that maybe I would rather leave the burger design to the professionals at Lil Woody's and their Doritos chip burgers.
Yeah, let's talk about this Burger of the Week, which you have not had, I'm assuming, since it just came out today. the Dorito burger with Mountain Dew mayo.
Oh my god.
I have no idea what that entails.
Okay, maybe we shouldn't leave it to the professionals.
Nacho cheese Doritos, pepper jack cheese, and bacon.
You had me until you said Mountain Dew mayo. Oh my god.
I don't know what that entails.
Okay, I don't know if I'm getting that one. But I think the thing is about these Burger Month burgers, right, is that they're chefs from very nice restaurants making a burger. And oftentimes, they might be crafting it in their own kitchens where they're really crafting it perfectly. But at Little Woody's, you know, they're still making burgers in mass, right? And quickly. And I think some of the artisanship can be lost when making so many burgers. And they kind of tend to get messy. I mean, this one, there was duck egg everywhere in this burger. It was all over the place. It was a very messy burger. The cheese didn't really fit in very naturally. I'm happy that it had cheese on it. And I wonder, what is with this war on cheese? Why was this the only burger with cheese on it? All burgers should have cheese on them.
Yes, I would agree.
But we discovered in our search for Seattle's best burger, which I had earlier tonight, three of them.
What do you mean?
The Tavern Burger. Remember we revised the Seattle's best burger?
Oh, did we?
We reevaluated. Look, there are a lot of Seattle's best burgers.
Some of us didn't reevaluate. Some of us just evaluated. Okay?
I'm pretty sure you voted for Dick's. but the thing that really makes a great burger, I would say, is simplicity.
Uh-huh.
And none of these burgers really understood that simplicity. I think they're chefs from very nice restaurants who tried to cram a lot of ideas into one burger. There was the burger for the second week that had like a wasabi chip underneath the burger patty. And it's like, this is a great idea, but it just doesn't work. It just doesn't work. Where are the nacho cheese Dorito chips? And this last one in particular, it's like, you could have had the bacon aioli or whatever, right? The bacon relish. Or you could have had the foie gras, the duck foie gras. But you just don't need all the things.
Right.
There was too much going on. And I think that was kind of my feeling about all of the Burger Month burgers. And I'm a little bit excited to move on and be able to have more simplistic burgers and focus in on places like the Tavern Burger.
I mean, first off, nothing was stopping you from doing that during Seattle's Burger Month, except for your quest for an apron. And I heard they were out of aprons.
They were out of aprons in Capitol Hill.
So do you get a rain check on an apron?
I wrote down my address and email, and they're going to update me on when the apron is coming. So I don't. It may have been a fruitless month.
Did they underestimate the demand for the apron?
They may have. Honestly, last year when I got the burger hat during Burger Month, I didn't feel like there were that many people participating. And this year, I looked around the internet, Twitter in particular, and I saw a lot of people participating.
That was just Ben. Ben and Chris.
Chris also. That's two more people than got burger hats last year.
That is a valid argument.
But I had a coworker also. There are three more people that I know personally who got the apron this year and ate all the burgers.
You can extrapolate out from that. So therefore, four times as many people.
Yes. And that's why they ran out of aprons.
Yeah.
It was still a good burger month. It's fun to try different burgers. Look, I'm excited about the idea of trying different burgers, but I think there was a lot going on each of these burgers.
Granting that I was traveling for a couple of these weeks and was home for only 2 days last week and like had to very narrowly fit in my dumpling consumption, the fact that I did not manage to consume a single one of the Seattle burgers is probably telling about how I felt about them.
Oh, it's a little bit more telling about yourself than it is about the burgers.
I regret nothing.
You still weren't competing as hard as you could. You needed to regress your perspective about the burgers to the mean.
Okay, fine. You know what I did have, though?
What was that?
I did have some Beecher's cheese last week.
Nice.
Because I hit up the Beecher's in the airport for, of course, mac and cheese. And then also I had the grilled cheese this time.
Oh, nice.
And then had a fruit and cheese plate on my flight back. That was
very, very cheese heavy. So where were you going when you had these Beecher's meals?
That was headed to Boston for the MIT Sloan Sports Analytics Conference.
Wow. That sounds like a fun time. Can you tell us about the Sloan Conference? First, I think I'm curious about some of the experiences that you had there.
At the conference itself?
Or surrounding the conference?
So I went to dinner on Thursday night with a group organized by a friend who works for an NBA team. And it's like his cousin's restaurant in
the
Boston suburbs. And there's probably three dozen or more people, mostly working for teams at this dinner. And then afterwards, everyone congregates at the Fours, which is a historic sports bar across the street from the Garden in Boston. And that's like kind of the place for NBA stats people to congregate.
That sounds like a fun time. People are calculating like how much alcohol by volume they're going to get per dollar on the beers.
You know, Derek Zumstang of USS Mariner once had a whole guide to this of how to like get as much alcohol content as cheaply as you possibly could at Mariners games or like around Mariners games.
Okay, so I'm not that far off.
Not that far off, but I have not heard anyone do that at the Fours at any point. The main problem was that it wasn't really a problem. They didn't have the Pac-12 network, so did not see a minute. That's
only a problem for you.
Of UW. Well.
Or a solution.
Yes. I also had at least one other friend there who was looking for the UW game.
Who was that?
My friend who used to work for the Husky Athletic Department and now works for the Warriors.
Okay.
So there was the two of us who were interested in the outcome of that game. And okay. There were also people who may have gone to Stanford.
So what were some of the best hangs? I remember a couple of years ago you were talking about you spent time with Nate Silver at the Sloan Conference. What were some of the best hangs at the Sloan Conference, aside from Barack Obama, of course?
I think the best hang was dinner on Saturday night, which several NBA team people, again, as well as several people from the Ringer, Kevin O'Connor, Jason Gallagher, and then Jason Concepcion, aka Network. So I sat like at their end of the table and just enjoyed coming up with suggestions for future episodes of Stats Under Duress. So that was probably the best hang. I mean, Jason is as funny in real life as he is on Twitter.
Really?
Yeah.
I'm going to ask this question later. I want to talk about the exhibition game.
Yes.
I want to transition to that.
We can transition to that at the end. Ask about Obama or something. I know. Oh, no, ask about Scheel.
Can't talk about Obama.
But I can talk about the transcript got out there. Did you not know that?
Yeah, yeah. I read the Deadspin thing about it.
Yeah.
So were you at the Obama conversation that happened at Sloan?
Of course. I mean, it was the highlight of the weekend.
Of course you can't talk about it.
I am not allowed to talk about the contents of what President Obama said. I'm allowed to acknowledge that he spoke and I was in the room. it's still an opportunity to like see a president be in the same room as them. That's not something that I've ever experienced before. So it was cool from that standpoint.
Is there anything that you can share from that conversation?
I mean, the contents are now out there on the internet, but I don't want to be the person responsible for discussing
it. It was funny because I read a lot of stories that were like, we don't know why this was secretive. Like, we've seen what was discussed. Like, literally, I think there's a video of the entire thing, right? And it seems like it's kind of baffling why it was secretive. But either way, being in the same room with Obama is exciting.
Absolutely.
And just that he targeted or was willing to be at the Sloan Conference is pretty amazing.
Yeah, I mean, I think speaking generally, I feel like I can say that one thing that was clear from the discussion is how closely he's following NBA news and like making references to things that had happened earlier in the week.
He's like the Jay-Z album referencing Al Sharpton, like taking the selfie in the mirror. Like, you're like, whoa, that's fresh. This is way too fresh for you to be talking about that, Obama.
I thought you were going to go with the Tupac "I recorded this a long time ago" sketch from Chappelle's show.
Also at the Sloan Conference, Scheel Kapadia tweeted something.
Former third Pelton brother, Scheel Kapadia.
He said, "Lyft driver bumped Biggie, didn't say a word to me, and provided a phone charger. Is there a way to leave more than 5 stars? Well, okay, no, that wasn't what he was talking about. No. He said, "At K Pelton, is there a rule at Sloan Conference that they have to mention you in every single panel?"
There's not a rule. No. There's no obligation.
Okay. You mentioned that much? Are you aware of how much you were mentioned in these panels? Were you at the ones that Scheel was at?
So Scheel thought that, I mean, we caught up, of course, which was a lot of fun.
And you're catching up was saying, which panels was I mentioned in?
Yeah.
You're like, we caught up. We talked about a lot of things. Congrats on the Super Bowl in Philadelphia. And what panels was I mentioned in?
He thought there might have been one that I wasn't at that I was mentioned in. But it was the Draft Day Analytics panel. My projections came up because Jonathan Givony.
Great movie, of course.
Yes, it was all about that. Jonathan Givony of ESPN was on that panel along with a couple of NBA scouts or front office personnel. And then the other one was the like building a championship team panel, which Sue Bird, another former third Pelton brother, was a member of that panel. And my ESPN colleague Jackie McMullen asked her about the statistical analysis I provided the Storm.
Wait, so it wasn't even Sue Bird who brought it up. It was Jackie Mack who brought it up?
It was.
Oh, man. Maybe we should have her be a third Felton brother.
She would surely be happy to do it because Jackie Mack is the greatest person.
Oh,
so and then
a legend,
Hall of Famer. The other time was I got mentioned my friend Aaron Barzilai, who put together a women's college basketball stat site, herhoopstats.com, mentioned me during his discussion.
Nice. Well, so that, congrats on being mentioned in a lot of panels and not being on any of them.
I would much rather be sitting in the crowd and be mentioned than actually be up there.
Always the mention in panels, never the panelist. Okay, so we talked about this the previous week. When you went to NBA All-Star Game in LA, you did not play basketball. And you told people the reason that you didn't play basketball was because your brother, who's 3 inches shorter than you, goes hard in the motherfucking paint.
I did not tell people that. Not unusual that I did not play basketball.
You didn't tell anybody that.
I know. I mean, I did tell people. I told people this week because I was telling people that I was a game time decision for the pickup games on Sunday
morning. You referenced the Waka Flocka Flame quote that I was also referencing?
No, I don't think at any point I mentioned that. I explained the context of playing a casual game in the driveway with my brother and my five-year-old nephew and getting elbowed so hard at the rims that I bruised my ribs and was still injured weeks later.
You said, do you see how hard my brother competes in a dumpling bracket? He competes in basketball 10 times harder.
I mean, I guess that is true.
Just wait for our search for Seattle's best tacos/burrito.
So it was a game time decision. I had not done anything. Like, I had not run until the first day I was in Boston. I ran on the treadmill like a half mile, and then it became
since
too painful
the Super Bowl
for me to continue. Yeah. So I was like, I don't know.
You got annihilated in the paint on the day of the Super Bowl.
That is accurate.
Okay.
So I didn't know how this was going to go on Sunday when I showed up to play pickup hoops. But whether it was the adrenaline or whatever, it did not actually hurt that much once I started playing.
It never hurts that much.
No, it does. It hurts a lot.
But it didn't in this case.
And despite playing terribly, making only one shot in six games I played and missing so many layups. Undefeated 6-0.
Wow.
That was great. You got very childish in your pitch there.
Whose team were you? Were you on like one really good player's team?
We didn't really have one really good player, but like three very solid players. So.
And you scored 2 points over those 6 games?
Yes. I was mostly just, you know, contributing defense.
But your RPM was really good.
Exactly.
And at the Sloan Conference, that matters.
I mean, my adjusted plus minus would be good. My RPM would not be good because the box score component, it would bring my stats way, way down when you accounted for that.
But, and really, at the Sloan Conference, all anybody cares about is your adjusted plus minus.
I felt good about the fact that I wasn't so terrible is to bring our team down.
Yeah, that's all that matters.
Exactly.
Who else were you playing with, though?
I don't know if anybody that the listener would know.
Really?
Yeah.
Okay.
A handful of various front office people. People who work for the league.
Who is the best player you were playing with?
There's a guy who works for the company Second Spectrum, which does the coordinate
data.
It's
a made-up company on The Office.
It does sound like it. Does the coordinate data for the NBA. And they like to exclusively hire players who like played at MIT or some school of that ilk.
Uh-huh.
It's like D3 players who also are really good at engineering, computer engineering. And so they have like a 6'10 guy who played center at MIT.
Oh, nice.
And he was on our team the first game and was like, this is good.
I'm going to pass him the ball.
I'm not going to bother rebounding as much. He's got it.
What position do you play when that's the case?
Stay out of the way.
Well, I'm happy you weren't so injured as to not play basketball.
Yes.
So I was wondering also, one of the big news stories, and we can kind of transition into this, one of the big news stories that came out last week, kind of shortly after we recorded the podcast, was that it's sounding like there's a lot of steam. Has this been 100% confirmed yet?
It is not 100% confirmed.
But that is for the Golden State Warriors and Sacramento Kings to play an exhibition game in Seattle.
Yes.
Before the 2018-19 season.
In this October or possibly late September, or I guess October 6th is the date that's been reported by the Sacramento Bee, who broke this story. And I think it was kind of unfortunate that the news first trickled out on the Kings side and the Warriors weren't part of it because everyone thought the Kings of all people are playing a preseason game in Seattle. Like, is the NBA trying to troll us? And the answer is no, the NBA is not trying to troll us. This was something that was not generated by the NBA. It was an idea that came from the Warriors. I had heard about them wanting to play a preseason game in Seattle as far back as October 2016.
This was like a bold prediction you made, 2014, 15, 16, 17, now 18.
Not exactly, but I did allude to this possibility. Ben B., our third Pelton brother, pointed out that after the fact, you will now notice that in my comments about you naming Kevin Durant your wild card pick for Seattle Sports Figure of the Year, I alluded to people liking him more in 2017, and that's because at that point, I thought the preseason game was going to be then. The Warriors ended up playing in China this preseason, so they only had two like preseason games in the U.S., so they didn't have time to come up to Seattle, but that desire was still there, and now they're going to do it in all likelihood this year. I mean, the deal is not official as yet. The contracts are not signed. The schedule won't be announced for several months, but all indications I've gotten are full steam ahead on this.
Nice. So how did this come together? What does this mean? What does this mean for the NBA in Seattle? Who's instigating this? Tell us everything about it. Was there any conversation about it at the Sloan Conference?
So again, it's the Warriors who are really behind this. And my understanding is that, you know, they had approached another team first who was unable to play in this game before getting the Kings as an opponent. I mean, you know, from the NBA standpoint, I think they did probably have to sign off on the idea of playing a game in Seattle. But it's not like something, again, that they're driving this to, like, you know, a test for how things are going to go in Seattle or the interest in Seattle.
I mean, it's gonna be good.
I would think so. I mean, there certainly was a backlash from some people on Twitter that you saw in the immediate aftermath. I mean, every person can decide this on their own, how to react to it. To me, if you're like, because you're still upset with the NBA or it annoys you that it's the Kings, I mean, to me, you're just depriving yourself of your best chance to see NBA basketball.
I mean, like, I look at this, and if it were the Kings leading the conversation, maybe I'd feel a little bit differently about it. But the idea that Kevin Durant, who started his professional career in Seattle, we don't know how much he's a driver of this necessarily, but that he's going to be playing a professional basketball game in Seattle for the first time since the Sonics moved is pretty amazing.
Yeah, and by all accounts now, this game is going to be at Key Arena. Will assuredly be the last sporty event at Key Arena before the rebuild begins. So Kevin Durant already had played in the last game for the Sonics in Seattle, and now the last sporty event in Key Arena, assuming, of course, he resigns. He does have a player option for next season.
If they had this game and then he doesn't resign, that'd be amazing.
I'm pretty confident Kevin Durant will be back. I mean, the other
we'll
person...
We'll get to see LeBron James in this game.
Other person driving this from the Warriors... I mean, only if the Sixers were the opponent. The only other person driving this from the Warriors standpoint, oh yeah, I'm very in on that, is Rick Welts, their team president, who grew up in Seattle, went to UW, started his career with the Sonics, was a ball boy for the team, I believe, when they won the championship in 79, and then later went off and worked in the NBA league office before getting into the team side of things and now being the president of the Warriors. So there are heavy Seattle ties here. And I think there's excitement among these organizations about the idea that this is a chance for the city of Seattle to see NBA basketball again and to show its passion for it. But I would not go too far in thinking like, oh, if things go well here, then the team's coming back.
Like, yeah, if they sell out this preseason game, it's almost like a B-movie like perspective.
Right. So like Vancouver has had terrific crowds for the Raptors playing there the last several years before this
there
current
be a team
season
in Vancouver, of course.
I 100% agree, but there's not really the same kind of steam for there to be a team in Vancouver despite those great turnouts. So
there should be a team in both markets. But this can be thought of as kind of a cleansing in some sort of way where it's like Kevin Durant played the last NBA game, the last official NBA game at Key Arena under different circumstances years ago. And now he's potentially coming back and playing this one last game before Key Arena is remodeled and potentially into an NBA-ready arena. Was there any conversation at Sloan about any movement for a team coming back to Seattle?
I mean, I'd say the sense that I got from talking to people is the same thing I've always kind of generally espoused and believed, which is that the NBA is not going to look at expansion until there are teams stabilized in all 30 markets And that isn't the situation right now with the Memphis Grizzlies, whose, you know, ownership dispute is still proceeding. And then the New Orleans Pelicans, their long-term future with their owner Tom Benson being 90 years old. Both of those situations, I think, remain unresolved and kind of the places to watch rather than expansion.
Interesting. And with the Grizzlies, obviously, bring them back home. But did you listen to the Bill Simmons podcast that he did following the All-Star break, where he said that...
Yeah, we talked about this last week.
Oh, did we?
Yeah.
Where he said he thought that Adam Silver would...
As I said last week, I'm pretty sure, I just don't think that the NBA sees the one-and-done rule as something that they're, like, negotiating to try to get. They see that as a concession to players who would want to be rid of the one-and-done rule. So they're not going to give them something else for that. If they're going to expand, it's going to be because it makes more financial sense for them. And again, I don't think that's the case as long as those ownership situations remain unstabilized.
Okay, so those are the things that we should be keeping our eye on in the coming months.
Yes.
And those are the two markets who I think we should be paying the most attention to any sort of progress that happens with their arena or ownership situation.
Yes. But we're also paying attention to the NHL expansion process. As we discussed last week, the season ticket drive for NHL Seattle begins this Thursday at 10 a.m. They'll be taking refundable deposits through NHLseattle.com, $500 for season tickets, $1,000 for club season tickets. And we learned a little bit more about the plans to rebuild Key Arena on Tuesday with the release of some new renderings of the plan for the arena. The big change, I think, they're showing that an expanded focus on the atrium on the south side of the current building being the primary entry point for people to come in and out of the arena, which is important because there were concerns about having a lot of pedestrian traffic on the north side where you have KAXP and other various offices, including where you used to work at the Vera Project. So they're going to kind of keep direct people away from that and towards the south side.
Well, and the entrances right now are on the east and west sides, right?
Right.
So they're going to have the primary entrance be on the south side of the renovated arena. Interesting.
Yeah, and then the other difference is right now, if you're going into Key Arena, you walk down, you know, to get down to the level of the lower bowl because of the fact that Key Arena is built so far underground and will be now even further underground once they renovate it. But in this case, they're going to fill in those steps downward, and the entry point will be at the upper bowl, I think, or perhaps the club level, but not at the lower bowl level.
And then you'll go downstairs once you're in the arena?
Or escalators, yeah.
Did you make anything in these renderings of the suites are called, like, ice boxes, or?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's...
Something specifically hockey-related. Did you make anything of that?
No, I mean, that's just part of, I think that's part of the design from the start. I mean, there's, you just have different, you know, configuration. The ice rink is larger in hockey than it is the court in basketball. So I think that's just...
But the suites would be the same, right? The suite level is going to be the same. Would those have a different name for basketball?
I think they're just called that because of the fact that they're, like, at the side of the rink on hockey. I mean, I'm speaking subjectively here, not knowing that much about the design of hockey arenas, but I think they're, like, at rinkside for hockey.
More about hockey architectural design.
But in basketball, there'd be a level of floor seats in front of you between you and the court.
So I shouldn't read anything into this?
No, I don't think that's a sign that, like, they don't care about basketball.
Okay, because that's what I was taking it as.
I'm taking it as the team colors are going to be red because the design showed the fans in the team wearing red in there.
Sockeyes confirmed as the team name.
Okay.
We'll keep monitoring this process. The next time that we talk, we'll have a very good sense of what the season ticket holder base will look like. And again, I think it's going to be very strong.
Yeah, I'm very curious to see what the response will be.
But speaking of strong expansion franchises...
The Seattle Sounders? The
Seattle Sounders and some tragic news this week.
Tragic? I don't know. Tragic seems a little strong here, but certainly sad news that, as we mentioned at the top, Jordan Morris, during the 83rd minute of the Sounders' loss at Santa Tecla FC in El Salvador in the first leg of the CONCACAF Champions League round of 16 matchup, was attempting to chip the keeper and landed awkwardly, twisted his knee, and suffered a torn ACL. I mean, it's a tremendous bummer.
I mean, before the season even starts.
Right.
Like, this is George Fant-level bummer.
Gordon Hayward. So there was initial speculation when this was first reported over the weekend that it could be a 6 to 9 month injury, which, as you alluded to, would allow him to be back within the course of the MLS season.
Even on the longer end. Right?
But the Sounders, their GM, Garth Lagerwey, immediately after they officially announced this, ruled them out for the season, which I think is the prudent play. I mean, you know, my experience is on the NBA side, but at this point, the ACL has really become more of a 12-month injury in the NBA. Guys like Jabari Parker and Zach LaVine missed almost a full year after they suffered this injury. And I just don't think it makes sense to have him rushing back to try to be back for the playoffs when he'd be at way less than 100% anyway.
No, I mean, it's just so devastating looking at this. This was supposed to be Jordan Morris's comeback year, right? After he had an amazing rookie season and then only scoring 2 goals last season, this was supposed to be the year that Jordan Morris was going to take the next step.
Yeah, and he seemed to be playing well in preseason, was playing as the lone striker in this match with Clint Dempsey and Will Bruin not playing. So, I mean, I think the good news is we know the Sounders can win without Jordan Morris. He was out basically the entire second half of last season, wasn't really a factor in their run to the MLS Cup. With Clint Dempsey and Will Bruin, they've got a lot of talent and experience at the striker position. Lamar Nagel can also play up front. I mean, they may be looking to add someone.
I think they'll almost certainly be.
Yeah, I mean, you want additional depth, especially playing the CONCACAF Champions League, although it may not be going on much longer. We'll see. We'll see what happens there.
And so the thing is, if you hadn't heard this, stop me if you haven't heard this, it's an extraordinarily long season.
You can't get worked up about things that happen, even like until August. Like, maybe in August you can start to worry about things in the MLS season, and that's a long time from now.
But also, it means that there are a lot of matches to play, and it means that the Sounders are going to need depth.
Yes.
And this severely affects them depth-wise, and I think that's why they're going to have to go out and make a move for a striker.
Well, I mean, I think the one thing is, though, we had talked a couple weeks ago about them playing a 4-4-2 formation at times during the preseason to try to get both strikers, you know, two strikers, both Morris and Bruin, or play Dempsey up top alongside Bruin. That's probably out the window now. I think you'll see them stick to more.
They're just scrapping that now.
I mean, that was a way to take advantage of the depth you did have at that position. Now that you don't have that same depth, I think you're probably going to see them go back to the 4-3-2-1 that, or 4-2-3-1, I should say, that Brian Schmetzer has favored during his tenure as manager. And that puts Dempsey in that attacking midfield role. Bruin is the lone striker.
Bruin can't play every match, though.
I mean, he's not going to play every match. You can move Dempsey up top. You can play Nagel there. I do think they will probably look to add
Nagel?
Some. Yeah. Don't say Lamar Nagel like that.
I mean, no, I'm fine with him.
Sounders
but being the lone striker? But it's not really his not position.
I mean, it has been at times. But you're not really... You're also generate a lot of scoring opportunities from your midfield with Dempsey, with Lodero, with Victor Rodriguez, with Wolf Ikram.
Okay. We can count on Wolf. All right, you've sold me.
Like, they still have a lot of depth.
I think they're going to have to go out and sign another striker, though.
Again, they played without Jordan Morris the entire second half of last season. It was just Bruin and Dempsey and Nagel then.
Long season,
they didn't
though.
Have anyone else. It's not like they lost anyone. It's still basically the same roster. In terms of the attack. Who? I mean, they played Jovan Jones at forward a couple times. They'd play him at the midfield, and that's no longer an option. But that's it.
All right. Okay, so the Sounders, what happened ultimately in that match in Salvador?
So Nicola Lodero scored an incredible chip from about 40 yards out in the 15th minute of this match to give the Sounders an early lead. But they conceded twice to Gerson Mayen after halftime to lose this one 2-1. The good news is they got a road goal. So a 1-0 win in the home leg this Thursday will send them through to the quarterfinals of the CONCACAF Champions League. But definitely not looking as easy as you would probably hope it would be in against a lesser foe, admittedly.
I still don't think this is a bad position to be in, though.
It could be a lot worse. And it was also a makeshift lineup. They were playing with probably about half of the starters you would expect over the course of the season. There was no Dempsey, no Bruin in this match, no Rodriguez, no Ikram, no Roman Torres. And many of those players will remain out. It sounds like Dempsey and Bruin will be in the mix. And
is Wolf Ikram going to be there?
I think so. He was dealing with a visa issue, we thought, was why he would be unable to play in El Salvador. But he's okay to play in the U.S. The other interesting lineup note is that we saw that Waylon Francis started at left back over Nuhu.
Interesting.
In place of Jovan Jones. And it was Francis who was called for a foul in the box that set up the PK that gave Santa Tecla the winning goal.
Okay, so that match is coming up on Thursday.
Yeah, and it's a congested fixture list here because the Sounders will be playing...
start the year.
Playing Thursday in the CONCACAF Champions League. And then Sunday they open the MLS season in the inaugural match for expansion team LAFC, which we hope will not be as successful in their first match as the Sounders were when they beat New York like 4-0 back in 2008. Which, by the way, 10 years ago.
Wow.
No, wait, it was 2009, wasn't it? It was 9 years ago.
Wow.
Strike that for the record.
It really makes me think.
It's the 10th season of Sounders soccer in the MLS.
So the MLS season is starting this weekend.
Yeah, and good so God. One thing you kind of have to figure out is how you prioritize those two things. Here was Brian Schmetzer's comment earlier this week after training. The next game is the most important game. We're going to get back to that. That served us well in 2016. And the most important game is the next game. I'm going to put out the best lineup for Thursday, and then we're going to assess and put out the best lineup for Sunday. Every game is a critical game for us.
Wow. He said nothing in that statement.
No, I mean, I think he said that they're going to play they're their best try lineup on Thursday. Well, I mean, obviously they're going to try, but... which I think is the right strategy. This is, like we just said, nothing that happens in the MLS season really matters until August. So look,
they can throw away that game on Sunday.
I don't want them to throw it away, but it's not as important, I think, as advancing the CONCACAF Champions League.
They could be in last place in late July and still win the MLS Cup.
That is all true. That is all true.
So they should focus on trying to advance in the CONCACAF Champions League.
Yeah, that's my perspective.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And there was discussion that if they did advance, they're playing a very weak Mexican side, right?
No, they would play Chivas.
Maybe I read something incorrect. I don't know. I thought there was whomever advanced out of this week would be there'd be a good chance of them being the first MLS squad to advance that far in the CONCACAF Champions League.
Teams have made it to the semifinals, including the Sounders. So that that wouldn't necessarily be a historic advancement for them. But let me take a look at the bracket here. And Chivas.
Is Chivas bad?
No.
Chivas is good.
I don't think so.
Oh, I don't know what I was reading. Are you
I mean,
sure?
I'm not paying that close attention to their current season here. I guess they did finish 13th in last year's Apertura. So maybe they're not as good anymore. But I don't know if I would call them a weak side.
Well, it's nice to see that Brian Schmetzer has the perspective, we think, that they're going to focus their attention onto this game on Thursday.
Yeah, it seems appropriate. The other Sounders news was on the broadcast front. KJR is taking over as the radio home of the Sounders this year. And then they will continue on Joe TV, but that's now the exclusive local TV home of the Sounders. Previously, really? They'd split those matches between Joe TV and KCPQ Q13.
And KJR is taking over for...
Previously, their games were on Cairo FM.
Huh. Yeah. Interesting.
Yeah. So probably some more Sounders talk on KJR, which there was not a whole lot beforehand. But not as much Sounders talk as you're going to get right here on the Pelton Cast.
Go!
They'll probably get more interviews with players than we will. I think that's safe to assume. Should we talk about the Seahawks?
And
should
we talk about is there Seahawks news?
Should we talk about the Yankees?
Oh, no.
Russell Wilson is there at spring training. He hit 6 home runs in batting practice on Monday.
Oh, that matters.
Yankees GM Brett.
6 home runs in batting practice?
Yeah.
Okay.
That was something.
Better than not hitting 6 home runs in batting practice.
Yankees GM Brian Cashman told reporters he'd be okay with Wilson getting an at-bat during a spring training game, but would like to talk to Pete Carroll about it first to get the sign-off, presumably.
Has he not done that when he's played in spring training previously with the Rangers?
No, I mean, I think he was just there for one day with the Rangers.
Oh, really?
Wasn't it? I don't know. I don't think it was a very long appearance.
And he's actually approaching this like he's there at spring training for a little while, the Yankees.
Yeah, I think 6 days, I believe.
It's more or less a publicity stunt, though. Come on.
I don't know if it's a publicity stunt. I think
this
it's
is
more
for,
like...
for Russell Wilson to get photographed in a Yankees uniform for the gram. Come on. Right?
It's more wish fulfillment than it is.
Wish fulfillment. It's a chance for him to talk to the team. Like, this is nothing. Why do we care about this? Why are we bothered by this?
I'm not bothered by it. I think it's, I mean, it's interesting.
Why are people bothered by it? Who cares? He's still going to be the Seahawks quarterback no matter what fucking baseball team he plays for in spring training.
My favorite
he doesn't even take an at bat.
My favorite is the idea that this is like leverage for him for his next contract. Like, you know what his leverage is?
Kirk Cousins is about to be the highest paid player in NFL history. Russell Wilson does not need leverage.
Exactly.
I really just hate reading about Kirk Cousins wanting to be the highest paid player in NFL history.
I say, especially if it's an NFC team, I'm all for it. A team that will not have the cap space to sign Kirk Cousins, despite not having the need either.
Look, trade Russell to the Yankees and sign Kirk Cousins.
I don't know how the cap, the bonus hit would work, how that would accelerate on the cap at that point. The Seahawks are carrying over just $547,000 in cap space from the 2017 season, per the NFL Players Association, which is the fifth lowest total in the NFL. But honestly, still more than I expected, given that for a while people thought the Seahawks were actually in violation of the cap last year.
I mean, wasn't that one of the conversations where they couldn't, it was Cam Chancellor, right? Who they couldn't put on IR because they couldn't sign anybody to replace Cam Chancellor?
I mean, not couldn't, but they saved some money by not doing it.
$575,000 or whatever. They're like, the things were tight.
They probably are still going to be tight this year too, but we'll see about that. This weekend is the NFL Draft Combine, so I'm sure we'll hear more about the draft and the Seahawks. And this will be an opportunity for the Seahawks front office and coaching staff to address the media for the first time really since the end of the season. So we'll probably learn a lot more about what they think of the new coaching staff, the changes that happened there, and you know, maybe get some indication of what they plan as far as whether they in fact do plan to franchise Sheldon Richardson, which sounds unlikely. So that'll be interesting to follow.
Yeah, we may have some clarification about the free agency process in the next couple weeks.
You are prepared to ignore all of it because you hate the NFL offseason so much.
I hate the offseason. Here's what I was saying to you the other day is the thing that I like about the offseason, until we get into the actual transaction period, which we can talk about transactions once they happen. None of that is happening right now, mostly.
It's not happening for the Seahawks. It's happening for other teams. I happen to be sitting two seats down from a guy who works with the Rams. When the Marcus Peters trade got broken during, like, right before Obama's speech, that was interesting.
Was he fired up about it?
I could not read his emotion about it.
Best offensive player, best defensive player, best ball-hawking cornerback in the NFL, LA Rams.
Todd Gurley is the best offensive player?
I think it was a consensus that it was Andrew Worth.
Okay.
But what I do like to talk about is I like the theory around football around this time period.
Debates about the value of running backs?
I don't know if I like the debate portion about it, but I like the idea of thinking about what we value, right? And I was having a conversation with the famous cousin Katie when the news of the Blake Bortles contract broke.
Uh-huh.
And I was saying to her, I like thinking about the NFL more philosophically at this point.
Okay.
Right? I just don't like the idea of this minutia that we get into with individual players, because this is the dead period. We don't need to think about individual players, individual teams. But I was thinking about the idea of if you are an NFL team, and I was looking at, I think, a chart with value for different positions from the draft as time progressed, right? And it showed that quarterbacks over the time become more valuable, offensive linemen become more valuable, and defensive linemen become more valuable, particularly rush ends.
Yeah, this was Ben B tweeted this out, right?
Yeah.
In terms of your impact on the team's record.
And I was thinking about, let's say you're the Jaguars, right? And what if you let Blake Bortles go, just walk as a free agent? Obviously, you have the cap room. But what if you drafted, say, four quarterbacks in the draft? Is this a crazy idea? I was just thinking about it as an idea as of you were a team and you just drafted quarterback after quarterback after quarterback.
I mean, I think the problem would be that drafting that many quarterbacks, like, there's diminishing returns to it because you've only got so many snaps during, you know, off-season workout, OTAs, and then also training camp. So I think I would draft a quarterback. I like the Packers philosophy, like, from the 90s of, let's just draft a quarterback every year in the late rounds. And then maybe they happen to work out, and that's great. And then we can, you know, it's Mark Brunell, and we can trade him for a second round pick eventually or something like that.
And you get something for them.
Right. So I like that philosophy. I also thought, I mean, the Seahawks strategy of just, like, throwing money at quarterback, throwing various resources at quarterback when it was their biggest need by far was an interesting one. So you go out and sign Matt Flynn in addition to drafting Russell Wilson.
I don't know if they expected Russell Wilson to pan out, but did you see the tweet where they were saying that the Jaguars are living out the real life scenario if the Seahawks had just rolled with Matt Flynn? I think that was a Spike Friedman tweet.
Huh. Yeah.
It really is true, right?
Yeah. But Matt Flynn, I don't know, was going to make quite as much money as Bortles is.
These are the conversations that I want to have during the offseason, though. Much more so than getting into the minutiae of individual players.
Or saying that all of them are going to get traded.
Or released.
So speaking of spring training, should we talk about the Mariners and who avoided what looked like it could be a blow early in spring training? Is Felix Hernandez left Monday's spring training game, his first start of the season, after he was hit by a ball batted back towards him in the forearm, apparently right on his All-Star 13 tattoo. This is a thing.
All-Star apparently. 13 tattoo.
Yeah.
That's what the Mariners players have to tattoo themselves with.
So it looked very, it was apparently very painful, but appears no serious injury there.
Okay, so people in, I guess, Mariners Twitter, right? This is something I peripherally pay attention to.
You're dabbling in Mariners Twitter?
And I'm not even dabbling. I just saw Mina Kimes tweet about it. People lost their shit.
It was somehow about that in conjunction with Russell Wilson played for the Yankees in spring training.
Those two things. But the way that I thought about this injury was not to go crazy about Felix getting injured. It was more to say, what do we actually expect from Felix this season? Like, I know that he has said he's going to return back to his king status, but has that ever happened?
Ever is a long time. I'm sure it's happened at some point.
Felix might need to regress his perspective about his ability for this next season to the mean.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure most athletes need to do that. I went and checked out Baseball Prospectus's PECOTA projections, and their mean forecast for Felix this season is for a 4.33 ERA and 1.5 wins above replacement player, which is basically identical to what he did last season.
It's like an okay starter to have.
Yeah, and given the Mariners' starting rotation, an okay starter to have actually is pretty important.
Borderline superstar for the Mariners rotation.
I don't know how excited you are about Marco Gonzalez lowering his slot and throwing harder.
Oh, I definitely knew that happened. I've been following Marco Gonzalez lowering his slot all offseason.
I'm looking forward to some hot takes from you on it.
But the thing is, like, we shouldn't be expecting that much from Felix either way. If Felix gets injured, this isn't Robinson Cano.
Yes.
Right? This isn't Nelson Cruz. This isn't Kyle Seager. This isn't even fucking Ryan Healy. Like, come on, people.
Ryan Healy's hurt too, right?
Oh, I don't know.
I think he's hurt.
We're talking about baseball here. Nobody knows.
Scholars are divided on the issue.
But just what we should expect from Felix, we really need to...
Yeah, he had surgery 2 weeks ago and was ruled out 4 to 6 weeks at that point. But apparently already participating in some defensive drills.
Well, great.
So there you go.
I look forward to what's happening with Ryan Healy. To following that story closely.
Also, is that how you pronounce his name?
I'm just saying. I'm just exaggerating it for effect.
Okay.
But I'm saying we need to regress our perspective of what Felix is going to be in the season to the mean.
Okay. Done.
Okay. Your perspective has regressed.
My perspective wasn't that great in the service place.
It was already regressed.
All right, let's talk about UW sports. Women's basketball finished Pac-12 play last season at 1-17, last in the conference. They lost to Stanford on Friday, 86-79, despite a conference season high 40 points from Amber Melgoza, who was picked to the 15-player All Pac-12 team on Monday, which also includes Mount Rainier grad Brittany McPhee of Stanford. Shout out Brittany McPhee. The Huskies then lost 83-67 in their regular season finale to Cal on Sunday, and they will face the Bears again on Thursday in the opening round of the Pac-12 tournament, which has been, you know, kind of an important thing for the Huskies in past years, and not so much this
will
year,
not be this year.
Where they will be playing on Thursday at 2 p.m. But I will be in attendance. That'll be my first Husky women's basketball game of the season. Doing the doubleheader, because I'll be at the men's game later that night. But in happier news, UW softball, now number one in both polls.
Here we go.
UW softball.
Oh.
We are a softball school. I have always said it.
Always have been, always will be a softball school.
Shouts to Danielle Laurie. The softball went 6-0 in the Mary Nutter Classic, including a 4-3 win over ranked Texas A&M, improving to 18-0 this season. This weekend, they will host the Husky Classic with a field that includes number 11 Alabama, BYU, Northwestern, and Portland State.
You don't mess with the Huskies in the Mary Nutter Classic.
Alabama, I thought, was like really good last year, weren't they? I feel like they were really favored in the College World Series before Women's College World.
They could have been. I think you might be thinking of Florida or Oklahoma.
Florida was very good, too. Oklahoma ended up winning, of course.
Of course.
Yeah.
We're going to follow this story closely, though. Look, we care about Husky women's softball
again,
right now.
I am confident you are not going to find any other general Seattle sports and food podcast with more UW softball coverage. Or, as I promised on Twitter, any other podcast that put together a projection, a model to project out the remaining two games of the Pac-12.
You have teased it.
Yeah, the remaining games of the Pac-12 regular season plus the conference tournament.
People have demanded it.
No one demanded it. I kind of came up with this on my own.
Tell us about your model.
All right, so I used just the kind of the results so far in conference play as opposed to, you know, like the full season kind of model you'd see on KenPom, but, you know, pretty similar at this point, I think.
Is this an effective model?
I think it's reasonably effective for what we can go forward, expect going forward. I mean, Arizona State's maybe a little underrated. They're like eighth in the adjusted point differential, adjusted for schedule. By the way, the Huskies, by this measure, have played the second easiest or the third easiest schedule so far in the Pac-12.
Thanks for the hate. Okay. Your model also is hating on the Huskies.
Because they, after this, they are the only team, I think they're the only team in the conference, or maybe one of only two, that has faced the three worst teams in the conference, Colorado, Cal, and Wazoo, two times each. The schedule broke very favorably for the Huskies, having to only play Arizona and Arizona State at home, and then also only the trip to UCLA and USC. So those are, you know, four of the best teams in the conference. Anyways, the Huskies, on average, win a little more than one game this weekend. The most likely scenario is that they split their two home games against Oregon and Oregon State, and they're more likely to sweep those games than they are to get swept. They can finish anywhere from third through seventh of the conference, assuming they have the tiebreakers correct. Their most likely scenario, intriguingly, is to finish seventh, the lowest they can finish.
Uh-huh. That's the hate that you've inputted into the system.
No, it's the hate that the losing both games to Stanford has really screwed up their tiebreaker situation. I mean, the good news is that they win any tie with Arizona State, so that's why they can't finish any lower than seventh in these projections. It is about a 22% chance that they get a first-round bye, finish in one of the top four spots, and automatically advance to the quarterfinals of the Pac-12 tournament. And overall, I project about a 26% chance of them reaching the semifinals, which is kind of, I'm feeling, that's probably what they need to do to make the NCAA tournament.
Okay, that's not bad.
Yeah.
It could be worse.
It's a reasonable chance. If you look at the latest projections, latest bracketology, after they split last weekend, losing badly at Stanford and then rallying from a slow start to end up blowing out lowly Cal, Joe Lunardi has them in the next four out. So that would be, I guess, 73rd in the power rankings out of the 68 teams that make it. He has USC in the last four in, UCLA in the first four out, and Utah also in the next four out.
It's still a lot of Pac-12 teams in that range.
Yeah, which a lot to be determined. Jerry Palm of CBS Sports has him in the first four out, has UCLA, USC in the last four in, and has Utah also in the first four out. So he's generally a little higher on the Pac-12 as a conference than Joe Lunardi of ESPN. So, you know, we'll see. I mean, I think if the Huskies sweep this weekend, that they probably would go into the week of tournament week, like in the last four in, I would guess.
What are they most likely, per your model, let's say that they do sweep, what are they most likely to finish in the conference?
If they sweep, there's a pretty good chance that they finish third or fourth in that case. Because first off, that automatically means they beat Oregon, which takes them out of the mix here. You know, they would win 11 games, and it's unlikely for, you know, Utah is the only other team that's really likely to win 11 games outside of course, Arizona and USC, who have kind of separate, I guess UCLA as well, but they're kind of a long shot. So they would probably finish fourth or fifth, I guess I would say.
So there would be a good chance of them getting a bye, though.
Mm-hmm. Or worst case scenario, facing Cal in the first round. You'd feel pretty comfortable at your chances of beating Cal in that case. So the various opponents that they, I also have this set up to look at the opponents they could play in the first round. The most likely opponent is Oregon State, followed by Wazoo. 27% of the time for Oregon State, 24% of the time for Wazoo, and then about 13% each for Cal and Colorado, both of whom they swept this season.
Do you ever just look back at that game at Oregon State and think, God damn it!
Not exactly in those terms.
Oh!
But yes.
If Oregon State hadn't hit all those threes, they are in the tournament right now.
Yeah, that's probably true.
This one, every year, one game against Oregon State screws them for the entire year.
I mean, there's probably a lot of teams that also look at the close games they lost to the Huskies. Like Arizona State is probably looking at that game that they lost.
One game! Arizona State.
Arizona is thinking about that Dominic Green three when they're not thinking about...
I think Arizona's fine. They're going to make the NCAA tournament. Stephen Thompson, I mean, Arizona, every year...
Arizona may not be fine. I don't know if you heard about Sean Miller not coaching the team anymore.
Maybe we should talk about that in a second.
We should talk about that in a second.
Okay, first let's talk about this weekend for the Huskies. First, they start with Oregon State, who they should be favored to beat.
They should be, although it's not an overwhelming favor. They're not overwhelmingly favored to do it. I mean, the thing that really stands out about that game, as you mentioned, the Beavers went 9 of 19 on threes. Their three-point percentage was far and away the best against UW in conference play, despite the fact that they are shooting a slightly below average 35% on threes in conference play. And Stephen Thompson, who hit most of those threes, is their only player even shooting 35% from three for the season on a reasonable number of attempts. So when he got hot, it forced the Huskies to kind of extend their defense, and that opened up a lot of space for Trace Tinkle to operate in the middle of the zone at the high post, which is, you know, the most vulnerable part of this 2-3 zone the Huskies are playing. And either he was able to score, or when, you know, the back line of that defense had to step up, then he was able to find their center, Drew Eubanks, for dunks. That's really kind of the ideal scenario. That's how you want to beat the Huskies. Make threes, get the ball in the high post, and then either score there or get the ball to the rim.
I desperately want to see Trace Tinkle have an awful game.
I don't think he's going to have an awful game. I would be surprised if he plays as well as he did down in Corvallis. Oregon State had one of the most extreme home court advantages in the Pac-12 this year. They are 6-3 at home, where their only losses are to Arizona, USC, and Utah, arguably the three best teams in the conference. Meanwhile, they are 0-7 on the road in Pac-12 play. So that's an encouraging
sign. And they played close with Arizona. They took Arizona to overtime.
Yep.
Stephen Thompson had a chance to win that game with a three that he missed this time.
I actually did not know anything about this game other than that it went to overtime. So I guess I'm glad I didn't. The Huskies want to make his younger brother, Ethan Thompson, beat them from the perimeter. He's a 30%
three. That's kind of like the Pelton cast.
Is it? You don't want to make you beat people from the perimeter.
You do.
Not relative to
me.
Well,
I mean, basketball-wise, yes. But everything else-wise.
Okay. Wow. So weirdly self-deprecating. Oregon State has also benefited from good three-point luck in conference play. They are second in opponent three-point percentage, behind only the Huskies at 33%.
What are the percentage chances of victory in this game?
I would say about 60%.
Only 60%?
Yeah.
Despite the fact that they have not won a single game on the road in Pac-12 play.
Yeah, I mean, the home-road split is actually usually not that predictive going forward. Usually predictive going forward.
Great. Okay, what about Oregon?
So Oregon, this was one of the stranger games of the season for the Huskies, who held Oregon to like substantially below their average output, at least in Pac-12 play offensively, to less than a point per possession, and yet still got blown out because they scored 25 points in the last 30 minutes of this game. Now, my memory of this game when I was thinking back on it was that like Kenny Wooten, who had a career-high 7 blocks in this game, their freshman who's kind of the new Jordan Bell, so to speak. Like, my memory was that he totally shut down Noah Dickerson with his size. That wasn't really the case. I mean, Dickerson...
Double-teaming Noah Dickerson in the paint.
Dickerson had 14 points on 5 of 9 shooting. Everyone else was terrible in this game, particularly Jalen Noel, who was 4 of 15 from the field for 9 points and 5 turnovers. And, I mean, that was a night that Noel looked like a freshman on the road in a hostile environment. I think he is likely to play better in this game.
Oh, I heard from the announcers that teams play really badly when there's no crowd there because they're used to noise.
Okay.
You couldn't hear the announcing on that game in Stanford. That was the home court advantage that Stanford had, is that people... don't cheer at the games.
That is next level. That is light years ahead, even.
So you're
the
saying
best home court advantage is no home court advantage.
It was not necessarily about Noah Dickerson being doubled in the paint, which is what we kind of felt watching game.
I mean, it would have been better if Noah Dickerson had continued to get more than 9 shot attempts in this game. But the reason they lost isn't because of the fact that Noah Dickerson got shut down. It's because everyone else shot terribly.
So he may have been setting up his teammates for open shots that they might have just missed.
Yeah, I mean, I think that definitely happened. They missed a lot of shots.
Okay.
There were a lot of missed shots in
that
game.
So when I think about the Pac-12...
They went 3 of 17 on threes.
Right now, I say to myself, of any team that I don't want to see have the Huskies play, number one is Stanford. I just think Stanford, they match up really badly with. Number two, because of this game, I think it's Oregon.
I'm not quite as down on the Oregon matchup.
Okay.
I don't think it's a great matchup. I do think they had a decent zone offense attack. They really got Troy Brown, their terrific freshman, in the middle of the zone. He had 21 points on 8 of 12 shooting in this game. The Oregon doesn't necessarily have the kind of shooting I think you would like ideally to play against the Huskies. They are 10th in three-point percentage so far in conference play, which is remarkable given that they actually lead the conference in free throw shooting. But Peyton Pritchard at 41% is their only guy who you really have to watch from downtown.
So we shouldn't necessarily go into this Oregon game saying to ourselves, the Huskies can't win this.
No, you definitely shouldn't say that. I mean, it's a tough game. Oregon's very talented. They're well coached by Dana Altman. I mean, I think they're going to be prepared for this one. It is likely to be a critical game. We'll see, you know, if Oregon... I mean, I think there's a pretty good chance that, like, seeding will be on the line in this game. So, you know, there'll be a lot of stake. Oregon, another team that also has been much better at home. They're 7-2 at home in conference play and 2-5 on the road so far. Although they'll almost certainly be 3-5 after playing Wazoo on Thursday.
I am ready for this weekend of college basketball. There's just a lot on the line here. With so many teams kind of bottled up in that same range in the Pac-12. I mean, like you said, with any chance for it going anywhere between 3-7 and with a chance of a first-round bye in the Pac-12 tournament on the line, this is going to be a fun weekend of college basketball, in as much as any weekend of college basketball can be fun.
With the FBI investigation continuing to hang over everything.
That was actually kind of fun.
Was it?
Right. It was a little bit fun. We had to see Lorenzo Romar be a head coach again. I mean, come on.
That was fun. It wasn't fun to see him lose to Oregon.
No, I did not like anything about that.
Much like the Huskies, Lorenzo Romar has not won at the new Mac Court, or Matt Knight Arena, I should say. Has not won since it was Mac Court.
Okay.
It's been a while. So on Friday, Yahoo reported the list of players who were in the files of the ASM agency led by agent Andy Miller is receiving payment or loans. At some point, a list that included a couple of Huskies, notably Markel Fultz.
A couple of Huskies.
DeJounte Murray was also down there.
I think a
dinner of $50 value.
Okay, so Markel Fultz was in a different range.
$10,000, yes.
A very expensive dinner.
yeah, that's a nice dinner. That is a high end dinner. I mean, I think that, like, you know, listening to the reaction to that people had to this, a lot of them were like, oh, finally all these big schools are going down because, you know, Miles Bridges was on this list, Wendell Carter of Duke was on this list, a number of high-profile players. Now, a few interesting things have happened. Number one, all of these players have continued to play, generally speaking.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you did have, I saw with Bridges in particular, a case where he was, made ineligible and then made restitution for, it was a similar case where a member of his family had accepted
dinner. It was like a $50 dinner.
Yeah, and he was able to pay that to charity and was immediately reinstated and became eligible again. Obviously, this is not going to happen after the fact. I think the one thing that would happen is if it was deemed that Fultz took this money, you know, during the season and therefore forfeited his amateur status. I hate to use the NCAA's terms, but I guess I will here. That it would make him then an eligible player, and the Huskies would have to vacate last year's 9 wins. And what a tragedy that would be to not have those 9 wins. I don't know how it would continue on as a program. I mean, there's more coming on this story, but, you know, to the extent that it really impacts programs, it's more like what we see with the allegations that, you know, Sean Miller was recorded offering $100,000 for DeAndre Ayton to play at Arizona. Ayton also continues to play at this point, but Sean Miller does not continue to coach Arizona, and it seems unlikely that he will ever coach Arizona again at this point. And I think this is still the tip of the iceberg in terms of that side of it. But I've also been very clear all along in this process that I think when we focus so much on the, oh, let's catch the cheaters, you know, let's find out who's dirty in college basketball, well, you don't want to excuse rule breaking. The focus here should be on how ridiculous and backwards the NCAA's rules are. And we shouldn't allow them to kind of shift focus to, oh, these players were terrible because they took money while they were trying to play college basketball. Like, there shouldn't be anything wrong with that. I think there should be something wrong with, you know, coaches specifically offering players money to go to schools. But if they want to get endorsements, if they want to take money from agents, you know, any of that, I think that should be their own business. And it seems ridiculous for the NCAA to regulate it. It's the last place that amateurism continues to hold out. We've gotten rid of it in sports like tennis and golf in the Olympics. And yet the NCAA somehow, long after expiration date, manages to march on blind to the advances of the last 100 years.
I was looking for a specific tweet about Miles Bridges that I couldn't find, but that I really, really strongly agreed with.
I would also say, by the way, if you find transcripts of what was said at Sloan, there may have been some commentary about this, and I may have agreed with it.
Well, and that's the question that I have for you is, honestly, I think people are viewing this through the light of like, oh, these programs are finally getting caught. Some people, not all of them. But I think the real revelation here is that it's kind of shining a light on how, I can't think of the exact word for what I'm trying to say. I don't want to say prejudice. The system? The system is.
Yeah, I mean, everyone is making money out here. Except
for the players.
Yeah, I mean, they are making perhaps some money, or their family are.
Yeah, like $400 for dinners.
But yeah, it's a preposterously small amount relative to the kind of money that they're bringing their schools and these agencies.
But I think that this is shining a light on how ridiculous the system is, more so than it is shining a light on these teams cheating. I think it's actually a net negative for the NCAA. I mean, it always is going to be, but it's more of a negative for the NCAA than I think they probably even realize. And do you feel like there's steam building, both when you were at Sloan Conference and in general through conversations, for there being the NBA getting rid of the having to go to college for 1 year rule?
Yes.
And kind of building out, say, the G League as a place that players could go right away. Let's say that they weren't players who are ready to play in the NBA right away, but they could be drafted by teams immediately or sign with teams immediately and get paid more or less an NBA salary, more than they're certainly getting paid.
Well, I mean, G League is not currently paying an NBA salary.
Well, they could negotiate whatever with those players, though, right? Is there a certain salary you have to get paid in the G League?
Yes, there's a maximum salary. It's very low.
I wonder if they could negotiate that also.
I mean, things can continue to evolve. And I think as they negotiate with the Players Association on changes to the age limit, that could be part of it. But I don't think that should be our focus yet. And I don't think things are going to dramatically change from like NBA pressure unless they start to put together like basketball academies where they're developing talent like the soccer model, as opposed to having it done through the grassroots organizations through the AAU system.
Which probably is also prejudice. But do you think there's any steam building for that?
I think that's a long ways off if it ever happens. I mean, I think the impetus, if it's going to happen, it's got to be probably the government putting the onus on the NCAA to like fix this.
Which there's some steam for, right?
Some.
Right now, the system is so...
Or lawsuits. The other aspect is lawsuits. Like, you know, the Ed O'Bannon lawsuit.
It seems
sort of
to have
thing.
Not pushed them that much though, right? It just means we don't get a goddamn college football video game.
If you would have asked me 7 years ago, you're like, you know, in 2011, like I would have expected that there would have been more change created by those lawsuits than has. Like, the NCAA is very good at kicking the can down the road, as many organizations are.
About keeping the money in their own pockets.
Yeah.
I don't know.
But they're just kicking, like, you know, they'll make some small changes and then relieve the pressure and you know, it doesn't build up and create this massive change.
But what's happening right now is every single step of the system until you get to NBA professional basketball or professional basketball overseas of some kind is very anti-player, right? The players are not seeing the money for their playing.
I mean, anti-player is strong because, you know, a lot of players, the benefits that you're getting in college basketball, the quality of the facilities and travel and everything like that, is a better lifestyle for them than it would be playing professionally. But the key is that, you know, they're not able to make choices about that. Like, you know, the reason you get work for salary and not primarily for the perks you get in your job, because the fact that it allows you to choose what perks you want.
Yes.
We all agree that money is better to have than perks chosen by your employer.
Yes.
So
Well, I think this conversation is about to start happening very soon. And I think
you are much more optimistic about this than I am. I think it's really going to all be about who are they going to catch next? Let's throw the book at them.
I really don't think that's been the conversation, though. Mm-hmm. I mean, with maybe look, there's a big difference between the allegations against players for the dinners and things like that and the wiretapping about DeAndre Ayton. I think there's a big difference between those two things, right? Because you're talking beforehand about an agent taking people to dinner, maybe some payments were happening. This is specifically the coach of the team talking about a large payment to a player.
Yes.
It's a very different thing.
I agree. But I also think that, again, the focus gets on how can we catch the cheaters? How can we punish them?
Who is having this focus, though? To me, the thing that I've seen online and the thing that I've seen predominantly...
I think you're in a bubble here.
I hate to break it to you. I'm looking at people responding. No, there were people disagreeing with you on Twitter.
There were a lot of people disagreeing with me, including notable college basketball analysts.
Wait, really? Who?
Yeah, Doug Gottlieb.
Doug Gottlieb specifically disagreed with you? Yeah, I might have blocked him on Twitter. I think I might not have seen that.
You want to pull that up?
Oh, I definitely want you to pull that up.
Okay.
Doug Gottlieb was responding to you?
Yeah. The tweet was, the level of inaccuracy in this tweet is stunning.
I say that about most of your tweets.
That's true. That is accurate.
But this is one that I don't disagree with. It just feels to me like there's a corrupt system, and more people are starting to realize that the system is corrupt and not looking at punishing the specific athletes or even the programs.
Again, I think that you are in a generational and perspective bubble, and that when you get to older people who are coming at it more from the standpoint of what's good for my college than what's good for the players, that they don't think this way. So I guess we'll see.
Great.
Well, on that note,
thanks for listening.
Thanks.